Our first speaker, we're going to start with Carlos. He's from Tucson. So I'm going to just ask him come up, and he'll, in his little talk about his experience, strength, and hope with Al-Anon, he'll let you know a little bit more about himself. So here's Carlos.
That's not good. I'm Carlos. Hey, everybody. I brought a few notes just so I won't get off track. I guess I got to do about 40 minutes, and then Sophie's going to come on after me. So I'm kind of curious. Well, first of all, how many people in here are not in Al-Anon? Okay, good, because I kind of wanted to just say, first of all, what Al-Anon means to me, because it's not really that obvious, and sometimes it's not even obvious to other Al-Anons, and it's not obvious to the Al-Teens that I work with. But first of all, you know, you've got your qualifier. That's your addict, or some kind of crazy person, somewhere in my life, and it's true. It's and once I accept the disease concept of alcoholism and I realize it's a mental illness, then that means that anyone with any type of mental illness really qualifies as my qualifier. So then I have to deal with the fact, like, one of my issues is that am I becoming like the addict in my life, you know, or am I trying to become so opposite of the addict in my life that I no longer have my own life anymore? I've become this caricature, just this complete opposite of the addict, the control thing comes in. Like, am I trying so hard to control the addict that I've taken the focus completely off my life and put it onto somebody else's life? That can completely make me lose who I am, my own sense of self. And then I take that controlling behavior about trying to control the addict, and then, because it's only natural, but then I spread that out into my worldview. I try to control everything in my life, everybody in my life, everything about my life, and it's very subtle, but it can infect my whole worldview. So those are some of, you know, the issues that I, you know, deal with in Al-Anon, even though I'm a double winner and I was a total addict. But I feel that my Al-Anon issues are actually more damaging to my life than my addictive issues, and so that's why I'm here in the Al-Anon room rather than over there. So, and I do believe the slogans. It's not an approved slogan, but they say, you know, who's crazier, an addict or a person who's, you know, chooses to live their entire life with an addict? And I do believe that the latter is kind of crazier. So, so my original qualifier was my mom, and she was a drinker. My earliest memories of her was just constant drunkenness and her and my dad arguing, and then that transitioned later into like almost like, I mean, like suicidal depression. So there was alcoholism and depression and lots of other things, and another thing that happens when you grow up around in an alcoholic family is that I became a total caretaker, and by doing that, I became like a miniature adult. I was like an adult at the age of 10, and switched roles with my parent. I became more like the parent, and the alcoholic became more like the child. And we were talking about this in my Al-Teen meeting, not my Al-Teen meeting, but the one that I sponsor. And what we didn't say was what's the payoff to that? And there, because there's a payoff to every behavior, no matter how dysfunctional it is. And the payoff is a feeling of control. It puts me in control. As a child, I'm in control of my parent. And how often does a child have a chance to do that? So that was one of the payoffs. There's other ones, you know. But there's also like a false sense of maturity. I mean, I felt like I was completely grown up by the age of 15, you know. But I realize, you know, years later that I was robbed of my childhood. That it was a raw deal. I would rather give back that false feeling of maturity and take my childhood back, you know. Another thing that happens in Al-Anon is that I feel that if my addict would just get better, then everything would be better, and that's not true at all. I mean, the alcoholic can quit drinking, but the family dynamics still continue. Or, for instance, in my case, you know, my mom eventually drank herself to death, and just because she was gone, that didn't make anything any better, you know. So that's another kind of a myth. But where was I going here? So one of my big Al-Anon traits that I developed was I became a feeling stuffer at like a super young age. I mean, I just had no more emotions. I could hide my emotions. I remember, like, I was a little kid, and I would have been like the perfect candidate for bullies, but they couldn't get what they were looking from me. They would try to bully me, but since I showed no feelings, I showed no fear. You know, I couldn't. You know, I didn't experience pain, you know, the way other people did. So they got nothing from me. You know, so they went on to the next little shrimp. You know, but I actually became their friends because these bullies also came from very dysfunctional homes, and they were all being beaten at home and just repeating what they saw at home, so oftentimes I would become their only friend. That's another thing too, like growing up in my family, kind of coming from that dysfunctional family, I didn't know it at the time, and I didn't seek this out, but like all my little friends were being abused at home, or had alcoholics at home, or were being, you know, beaten or something like that, or they came from like super cultic, like religious, hardcore religious families or something like that. And I just was immediately attracted to these people. So I never was wanting for friends, because I mean, if I got into a strange situation and I felt, you know, lonesome or out of place, I would just look for the other misfit, and then immediately we would, you know, be friends. So that was my MO, you know, throughout childhood. So you know, continuing on with what it was like, there was no higher power in my home. My parents had come from a really strict religious background, so in response to that, they raised me and my sister in a totally atheist environment, and not just agnostic, you know, not just like we don't know for sure. They were just like, no God. And you couldn't even speak of the type of things that you might hear in a spiritual context, like hope, you know, something like that. You just couldn't speak in a broad general term about a concept like hope you couldn't speak of like something like forgiveness or love in an abstract term the way we might speak about it in a spiritual sense. So that kind of put me at a little disadvantage there too. So the sad thing is that, you know, I grew up just hating alcohol with a passion. I just hated the smell of it. I just hated everything about it. I hated the empty bottles piling up everywhere. I mean, so how the hell could I wind up becoming an alcoholic? You know, I mean, that's to me, that's the biggest mystery, to take something that I just hated so passionately. Or just to start with an easy one, how about cigarettes? You know, this was back in the old days where we would drive around in a car with the windows rolled up, with, you know, my mom and dad just smoking like crazy, and us kids were just dying and back. And I can't stand that, and the smell of all the overflowing ashtrays all over the house. How could it be that then at the age of 12, you know, I was smoking, you know, like leftover cigar butts or something, you know, me and my crazy friends. You know, I don't understand to this day how you can go from being in a family where you know, you can clearly see how everything is so screwed up, and then emulating that behavior. So that's another one of the mysteries of Al-Anon. And you know, as they might say in the AA meeting, you know, about remembering your first drink or something like that. I don't really necessarily remember my first drink, or my first cigarette, or the first time I did heroin or anything like that. But I do remember the first time that I did it, and I didn't want to do it. I did it because I had to do it, not because I wanted to do it. And I remember looking down at this cigarette, and I used to just smoke just for fun, and I was looking down at one, and I was thinking, I don't really want to smoke this cigarette, but I have to smoke it. And I knew that if I lit that cigarette and smoked it, that there was no turning back. And of course I lit it. And I remember doing the same thing with the first time that I did that, when I went from just drinking just for fun to drinking because I had to. And the same thing with, if you can believe, you know, recreational heroin use. I mean, I did for like 6 months. It was really just recreational. And then I just remember that one the one time I was looking at that spoon and I was thinking, you know, I'm not doing this for fun anymore. I'm not doing it because it feels good. I'm doing it because I can't not do it. And I thought, if I just put it down, I'll be fine. But I didn't put it down. So then we'll just say that the next 12 years were just this period of just crazy drug and alcohol addiction, and I'm not going to even go into any of the crazy behavior, you know, during that time, because, you know, everybody had their crazy behavior, and everyone probably had some crazier than me or whatever, or more horror stories or something like that. But so I'll start to tell you how it started to get better. I remember my first Alateen meeting, and if you don't know, Alateen is for kids who are growing up in an alcoholic household, and they may or may not have their own alcohol issues. But my mom was locked in a psych ward. I mean, literally locked in, and this was not like a fun treatment center with crafts and meetings and stuff. It was a psych ward, and the social worker pretty much just made me and my sister go to an Alateen meeting, and I was just like floored. I mean, these kids were so like me, but my ego told me that they were so not like me, and they just scared the hell out of me. I was scared by how real they were. I mean, they were facing up to stuff that I was not facing up to. I knew about alcoholism intellectually, but I had not internalized really what it was really all about and the effects that it was having on me. But these kids knew. I mean, they read the literature and they knew, and they were very welcoming. You know, they were, there's nothing wrong with them. They weren't geeks or anything. They were, you know, they were just as cool as I thought I was at the time. And I could not take their reality, and also I couldn't take their higher power. I thought it was weird. I just had nothing to compare it to. So, you know, I went to a few meetings pretty much just because I had to do it, and then I got out of there, and I never had any. You know, I would not have anything to do with 12 steps for, you know, fast forward, like I say, another 12, 15 years, you know. So so around about at the point, my lowest point of hitting bottom, and I will also say that if you grow up in an alcoholic home, you see how to drink, you see how to manage it, you see how to handle it. So I was what you'd call a high-functioning addict. I didn't spread it around. You know, I didn't make a big deal out of it. I would drink a lot in private, and I always held a job and stuff like that. But that's not a good thing. What that did is that prolonged my hitting bottom for years and years. I mean, I could have probably managed it for the rest of my life if I had not had some sort of a spiritual awakening. And a lot of people do. You know, they'll go to their graves drinking. But I finally hit sort of an emotional bottom you know, my life wasn't in ruins or anything like that. I hit an emotional bottom, and I decided that I needed to turn things around, and I realized that the hardest thing for me, because I had loads of willpower, and I knew I could kick, and I knew I could quit drinking if I really wanted to, but I also knew that I would have to face all my fears, number one, which that would be the hardest part. And then the other really hard part would be that I would have to give up my sort of sense of sadness and misery, which is a strange concept, that my misery, I like to call it, had been with me my entire life, and it never went away. You know, happiness would come and go, but misery was always there. Booze might come and go, but misery was always there. Drugs, of course, always come and go. You never have a good supply. Even the high from booze totally comes and goes, and it's inconsistent. It's replaced by horrible hangovers. So misery was like the only consistent thing in my life. And as I was contemplating quitting, you know, I would look at these guys in the gutter and stuff like this, homeless guys, and I was jealous of them. I'm like, look at that guy. He's just like he's just like so into his misery. And I thought, you know, when I get clean, you know, I'm not going to have that. What am I going to have? I'm going to have a very uncertain life. I mean, my emotions that I've been stuffing for years are going to come back, and what is that going to feel like? And so that scared the hell out of me, you know. And I also felt that my misery was kind of like a friend. I'd be turning my back on a friend, you know. So that was one of the hardest things for me. But I white knuckled it through, I did. I just willpowered my way through. I mean, I didn't even do 12-step then, and I was good for, you know, a couple of years without a relapse or anything like that. And then I realized that my sobriety was kind of hollow, and it didn't really. There was something missing in my life, I'll tell you a super quick story about an old friend that I had at the time, and a couple of you have heard this story. His name's Jeff, and he was a big brother of Kiki, and she was a tweaker. We called her Tweaky Kiki. So we would get really high, and instead of going doing crazy stuff, we would sit and talk about how great life was going to be when we were sober someday. I mean, we would do this. We would do this. Oh, well, I'm going to start exercising. I'm going to do yoga. You know, I'm going to do all this stuff. And then he would say, you know, he says, yeah, why don't you try Al-Anon? And then I'd get really pissed. But he would throw it in there every now and then, and then I would get really angry, and he would later say that he would say, like, I would say, oh, you know, I just broke up with my girlfriend, you know, and he'd say, yeah, you know, that might have something to do with your mom being an alcoholic. You should try Adult Children of Alcoholics. And then he'd say he'd have to duck because I would swing at him, you know. And then fast forward. My mom drank herself to death, and then his mom drank herself to death, and literally he went to visit her in the hospital, and it was like, he said it was like a skeleton with a, they let her drink in hospice, it was a skeleton with a drink in one hand and a cigarette in the other, and he says, Mom, you know, you're dying, and you've never told me you love me your whole life. It would be great to hear that. And she's like, Jeffrey, go get me a drink, you know. And so that hit him really hard. So his mom died, you know, without any resolution of any of their stuff. And then he was reunited with his bio dad, and then his bio dad was diagnosed with cancer, and it all got so bad that he just got like really super depressed. And I was at his house one day, and he was depressed, more depressed and sad than I'd ever seen him in my life. And we started talking about some stuff, and again he recommended Al-Anon. And this time I had it. I said, what the fuck are you talking about? I mean, here you are what is it? It hasn't done anything for you, and you're recommending it for me. And his eyes were just red from crying, and he just said, just because it hasn't done work for me doesn't mean it can't work for you. And a week later, he had committed suicide. So after that, you know, I had to give it a try, you know, and I went into my first Al-Anon meeting, and again, it was just like that Alateen meeting. It was like I loved you people, but I hated you people. I mean, it was like I loved you because you were like me, but I hated you because you were like me, it was so hard. But I thought, what harm could it do? You know, it can't hurt. It doesn't even cost any money. It's not. I don't have to join anything. These people don't have to know who I am or anything. You know. So I just sort of logicked my way into it. I just thought, what the hell? Just give it a shot. You know. So I did. You know. And I never turned back. You know. So the higher power thing. That wasn't as hard for me as you'd think, because I always had the what they call the still, quiet voice of God, you know, somewhere in my crazy brain. And I was doing everything I could to keep that voice at bay and not listen to that voice. So it was like I was holding it at bay and turning up the volume higher and higher so I could not hear that voice. And sober or drunk, you know, even after I got clean, it was the same way. And I was just convinced, you know, by observing people in Al-Anon, just to give that higher power thing a try. And all I had to do to try higher power, I didn't have to go seek higher power at the top of a mountain or find a guru. This was even before I had a sponsor. All I had to do was just stop forcing God out of my life and just lower my hands, and then God just came into my life, and it was a beautiful, wonderful thing, and I didn't have to do anything. I just had to stop resisting it, and it happened, you know. So because I think God is everywhere. I mean, you don't have to, you know, believe in, you don't have to do anything for higher power. Higher power is just there, you know. So the minute I stopped resisting higher power, then there it was. And then, of course, I did a lot of tinkering around the edges, you know, because we're allowed to create our own higher power however we want. So I did a lot of that, and my idea of my higher power has changed a lot over the years, but it's always been enormously loving higher power. No wrathfulness or, you know, whatever. My sponsor finally got me a sponsor, you know, and he always said that the two, while he was talking, you know, thinking about like spiritual awakenings, he said that the two highest expressions of love are gratitude and forgiveness, and those are the things that I really found so much in Al-Anon. And I needed a lot of forgiveness. I mean, I was talking to my sponsor, and before we even got into the steps, you know, he says, you got to start forgiving yourself, you know, because I was just really down on myself. I didn't even know I was down on myself. I just walked around with it, and it was obvious to everyone else, but not to me. And that was the most loving and forgiving man I've ever seen. If I would have told him, you know, that I accidentally started a forest fire that burned a million acres, he'd just say, well, everybody does it some, you know, or anything. I mean, so forgiving, and he's really taught me that is a, you know, a real central point in my program. Gratitude is just huge in my program now, but it's tough with young people, I realize, because gratitude, whether you want it or not to happen or not, it comes out of loss most usually. And if you're too young to have experienced a lot of loss, then how can you know about gratitude? So I hope, you know, that the young people here never experience enough loss to really have to feel that grateful for that, of everything. But I mean, I felt like I lost everything in my life by the time I was even just like 17 years old, you know, and So gratitude just became huge with me. So I guess I'm getting to what it's like now for me. I mean, I have sort of like a rule book to live by that I never had before, but it's not a judgmental rule book, and it's all just suggestions. There's no authority figure that can force me to do anything. Everything I do is voluntary. It's on my own basis, and I've got a place to go if I need some sanity, you know, for an hour, you know, just and I know that I won't be judged, and I can say pretty much anything I want. I know that I, you know, won't be interrupted. That was amazing. You know, before I got into the program, I had no idea about crosstalk. I thought crosstalk was a great thing. You know, I thought that was, if you weren't getting crosstalk, if you weren't interrupting or being interrupted or interrupting others, I thought that there was no interaction going. But that's because I'm part Italian. And it's but same thing with arguing. I just love to argue. I've let go of a lot of my arguing because that comes under wanting to control people. You know, so. And then the same thing, like I say, as far as judging, I was super judgmental, but my sponsor helped me realize that I was judgmental of others because I was judging myself so harshly. And as I stopped judging myself so harshly, then for some reason, magically, I don't want to judge you guys. You know, I don't care what you guys do. And then the only other thing is I think that Al-Anon has made it, and I can only speak for myself, but I mean, Al-Anon has made it safe for me, again, to have friends who are not in Al-Anon, and even friends who, you know, scoff at 12-step stuff, and because, you know, if I keep my program, you know, pretty solid, then I can venture out into the crazy world, and there were some times when, you know, I got to admit, you know, I got, when I kicked everything, I got pretty preachy, you know, and I really jeopardized. I almost jeopardized a bunch of friends. I lost a lot of friends, and that's okay. But I jeopardized some friends that I didn't want to lose. For instance, like her parents over there. I mean, I was just so obnoxious that they were finally like, "Look, you either got to shut up with that, or just that's it," you know. And I would have walked away from them, but I wanted to have her in my life, you know, still. So. And I knew that I would lose that, you know, if I continued on, you know, with my preachiness. So pretty much now, you know, I just try to let other people live their own life, geez, you know, I'm just about done. But let me tell you a little story. I wanted to have one of the Phoenix Alateens. Well, I guess I should tell you the Alateen story. I mean, I don't do a lot of service work as far as being a treasurer or something like that in my home group, but I got involved in Alateen because I just wanted to be able to give back, you know, something. You know, I didn't know what, and they said that, and nobody else wanted to do the Alateen thing. I mean, it's just the truth. I mean, when I got into it, they had no sponsors and no guy sponsors either. So. And a lot of the adolescent male Alateens, they were a handful back then. They're pretty tame now, but they were hard to handle. And so, so I got involved in that, and that's been so rewarding because it's allowed me to look back at the most painful period of my life because they're experiencing it right now. And I wanted to flee that point in my life and never return, never revisit it mentally or physically or anything. And these guys forced me to relive it every Tuesday night, you know. And so I think it's really good for me. The reason I mentioned it all was one of the Alateens that didn't make it down from Phoenix. He was. Oh, I was joking with him that I was going to do a PowerPoint today instead of speaking. But then we started to deconstruct the idea, and we were saying, "Well, okay, you can't do it because the photos." You know, I didn't want to show you guys a bunch of photos of when I was all crazy and shit. But it also would violate other people's anonymity too if there were other people in the photos. So he had the idea to do like draw out these things and do like comics of my life, you know, my crazy life. And he would, you know, like a, you know, like a photo or a drawing of a building on fire, and he'd say like, this is when my dad got drunk and he with a cigarette and he burned the house down. And that didn't happen to me. That was like a for instance, you know. So I think that's a really good idea. So if I'm ever asked to speak like at the Alateen conference, which is called AZAC, I think I will do like some kind of a presentation. And for those of you who are not in Al-Anon, the Alateens have an awesome conference, and I would try to get, you know, any of these of the young AAers to go to that, because whether they need it or not, you know, it would just be a great thing for them. I don't know if anybody on the committee brought any information. We don't have any information. Our next conference is like still 11 months away, so I don't think they have any information. But we'll try to network with the Young People's AA and to get that all going. But I'm done. Thanks, you guys. So next speaker is Alateen speaker. This is Sophie. She's got 6 years of recovery. All right.
Just like you. I like this microphone. Hi, I'm Sophie.
Hi, Sophie.
And like Carlos said, I've been in Alateen for 6 years, going to his meeting for 6 years. So I'm very grateful for him having brought me into it. And every time I speak, I have no idea what I'm going to say until I listen to the person before me, so I'm still terrified. That's okay. Jesus. So, before Alateen, when I was a little kid, I'm going to go off of a different story than I've told before. But anyways, my parents didn't really drink around me. I don't think I've ever seen... That's a lie. I've seen my mom drunk here once, and it was hilarious. But anyways, my dad drank once in a while with friends and whatever, but not really around me, sort of. And but the big thing was my parents had both come off of drugs before I was born, like right before, essentially. Well, my mom sooner, because she was pregnant. But anyways, my dad still was fairly dysfunctional and took me to some houses I probably shouldn't have been at. And there was one of his friends lived in his basement, and I was 7 years old, and there's this other little boy who's become like my little brother now, and he was 2. And what I was always told was, hey, keep the kid away from the blow. I was like, okay, doing good. So there was a lot of that, and being around people who were just getting messed up all the time. And I thought it was funny because I was a little kid, and they're saying stupid things. I was like, hey, I'm smarter than you. Good job. But it was also really hard to deal with because I was also thinking, hey, I'm the little kid and you guys are acting like more of a little kid than I am. And that's kind of a problem, just saying. But so that was really hard to deal with sometimes, and then other times it was awesome because I could get what I wanted. And then there's a lot of other nonsense, like my parents fighting constantly because they're both crazy. And my mom she grew up in an alcoholic home because, like, when she was like 3 or 4, she was mixing drinks for her dad, and I mixed drinks for him too when I was like 5. Doing good. And so she grew up in that alcoholic home, so she had a lot of Al-Anon characteristics of the ism, I, self, me deal. Yeah, she's good at that. And so she'd always take out her anger with my dad, like, going wherever he wanted or whatever. She'd take that out on me, who would get upset and go to my dad, and that would start a huge fight. So there's a lot of screaming and stuff when I was growing up, and it was nonsense. And then I got into middle school, and kids were starting to experiment with drugs and drinking like fish. It was just ridiculous. It was like, hey, you guys are not even 13 yet. What? And so when I was 12, Carlos asked me if I wanted s'mores on a Sunday. I was like, yes, I do. So we went to a campfire meeting, And I didn't really know what to make of it because I didn't know what the hell was going on. There was just a bunch of kids sitting on big oil drums that were probably full of toxic stuff. And they were talking about stuff that I was just like, what are you saying? Like, I don't think of things that way. I just pretend they don't happen. How are you identifying with it? And so I just kind of listened to them because they were all a lot older than I was by like 2 or 3 years, which seemed like a lot in middle school. And for some reason, I don't know why, because I was totally intimidated by these kids, but I kept coming back. I think it was probably because there were more offers of s'mores. And then Carlos asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting on Tuesday, and I was like, that's a school night. I'm never going to be able to do that. But I was talking to my mom, and she talked a lot of crap on it because she doesn't like 12-step programs at all, and she likes to instill that in me, and it's not working. Huh. But I convinced her to let me go, and I still didn't know what was going on because there's still all those kids who are older and they're talking about everything. I was just like, what? And then I got into high school and I got into marching band, which was ridiculous, but that took up my Tuesdays, so I couldn't go to Alateen anymore. And I didn't think it'd be that much of a big deal because I didn't think Alateen meant that much to me until I started going, and I missed like 3 or 4 meetings, and it just sucked. Because at Alateen, even though I was really quiet and afraid of everything, I could still think about things and sometimes say, like, what's going on. But then in marching band, it's a bunch of hyperactive freshmen, and it's just, you can't talk about that sort of thing because they're all ridiculous and bouncing off the walls. But I finally got, after the season was over, I went back to Alateen, and it was a whole new group of kids. Like, there's probably like 3. But there used to be about 6, and they all disappeared. But, so I was kind of, like, the oldest one there, which was weird. So I kind of started to take control of it and make it, not my meeting, but sort of take control of my own place in it. So I actually led a meeting, and that was the most terrifying thing I've ever done, ever. It was so scary. But it kind of made me look at things, like, what I didn't see when I was little, when my parents were being insane. I thought, oh no, they're just crazy, that's all. And then I kind of started thinking about it. I was like, no, they grew up in alcoholic homes, and this is their response to it. And I grew up in a crazy home, and I'm learning how to respond to it myself in a better way than going down strange routes of nonsense. But, so yeah. And I kept coming back, and kept coming back, clearly, because I've been in it for 6 years. But recently-ish, I've started being dumb, put it that way, and kind of letting other things control myself, which is bad. And for a while, I didn't care. Like, I was doing things that I shouldn't be doing, and I didn't care if it went against everything I'd learned in Alateen. I didn't give a shit anymore, because there was a lot of nonsense going on, and I was just hateful of everything. Then somebody, I don't know who, it doesn't really matter, somebody shared something at Alateen that made me think about it and think about how can I be destroying myself when I come to Alateen to share about how my parents are destroying themselves and making my life hell. So I was kind of being contradictory to myself and realizing that, like, my parents put me in a bad place, I was putting my little brother in a bad place, because my little brother is autistic and relies a lot on his family. And by taking myself out of the house and doing things I shouldn't, I'm not setting a good example for my brother, and I'm not there for him, which is exactly why I was mad at my parents, because they weren't there. They were doing stupid things and not there for me. So I'm starting to get that, because that realization didn't come until like 2 months ago. So I'm starting to understand that I need to straighten stuff out and work at this, actually work at it. And it's really hard to work at Alateen, just saying, because it's taking responsibility for yourself, and I'm 18, I don't want to take responsibility for myself. I don't care, but I can't get away with that, and it's really frustrating. But I'm learning. I'm getting there. And my slogan for now, my slogan used to be one day at a time. All the time, because I take things, I try to do stuff that's happening in a month and take care of it now, and it's not working. And the new one with all the nonsense is, how important is it? Because everything as a teenager is the world. It's, if this doesn't get done, life is over. Everything's dead. Universe is falling out of the sky. Screwed. But then I stop and look at it and like think of things I got so pissed at like 2 months ago and realize, hey, I'm just fine. Things went to hell. I fixed it in an hour. Why was I freaking out so badly? So it's putting it into a different perspective, choking on words. And it's hard, but it's something that I'm learning through Alateen and especially Azak, because Azak is amazing. And I don't know. I'm going to keep trying to come back to Alateen, and I don't want to turn 21 and become now. I'm just saying. Alateen's better. Promise. Alanons kick us out of our cool room. Not our fault. I want to stay in Alateen for a long time, and I've only got like 3 years left. That sucks. But I know, I'm really grateful for Alateen and for all the little Alateens who are coming to the meeting, all the new kids and everything, because they're getting all the help that I needed when I was little, and a lot of them are getting it sooner, and it's pretty awesome. And I'm just grateful for the program, and I'm done.
Okay, thank you, Sophie and Carlos. And with Carlos and Sophie finished, our last speaker today is Hannah T. from Tucson, and I'll let her just come up.
Hi, I'm Hannah. I think I saw a penguin earlier, and I was thinking it's so cold, and I was down there in the last panel, and it's colder up here, and I'm like, it's because it's a higher elevation. I figured it out. So I got my gloves on. First of all, thank you, Carlos and Sophie. I know that I've heard that we come into Al-Anon or we come into program when we're supposed to, but I just can't help but wonder how my life would be different if I had Alateen. I mean, I just wonder that a lot. Anyway, I'm going to start my story off by telling you about Al-Anon meeting that I went to in Virginia. Now, I've only known Tucson Al-Anon, and my brother lives in Virginia, and I went out to visit him, and I decided to research what meetings are around, and I found one particular one that was right by his house, and I said, hey, I want to go to this Al-Anon meeting. You know, you're welcome to come with me, but I'm going to go to this Al-Anon meeting. And my brother's not really into Al-Anon, but he's come with me now and then. And he said, sure, I'll go with you. So we walk into this Al-Anon meeting, and we walk in, and this woman sees us, and she freaks out. And she says, oh my gosh, in all my years of Al-Anon, I've never seen Asian people at a meeting. And she says, when I think of Asian people, I think of meditation and incense and tea. And my brother, who is so diplomatic, he says, that's interesting. Me, I'm like, oh, no, you didn't, lady. It's on now. You know, I was pissed. And luckily, this man stood up and he said, excuse me, but alcoholism can affect anyone, any race, any economic situation. It does not discriminate. And I said, I was thinking, thank you. Thank you. So we began the meeting. And, you know, I came back with such an appreciation for my meetings, and I kept saying, I mean, for months after that, I was like, thank you for not doing that at my first meeting. I would have run away and never come back. Thank you, you know, for not treating me different. and welcoming me as one of you. And I remember that, you know, when newcomers come in, who knows what state they're coming in. You know, they could have a black eye or some, you know, whatever. But I am very conscious not to react and welcome them. So I am grateful that I'm welcomed and not treated as different, because that is one of my issues. And here begins my life, is my parents are immigrants from Hong Kong. I was born and raised in Minnesota, a small town in Minnesota. A small town in Minnesota in the early 70s. Okay, this, talk about feeling different. It was full of blonde-haired, Scandinavian, Swedish people. And I'm not talking just blonde. It's that platinum blonde, you know, that beautiful white hair. And, you know, we were stared at a lot. I think they've just never seen people that looked like us. And we were the first Asians into our neighborhood, and which was met with a lot of resistance. I didn't know at the time, I was four, but I had learned later on that there was protest to keep us from buying the house and moving in. So there was a lot of prejudice. So, you know, now I can look back and say, I am really glad that I grew up in Minnesota, because it was a beautiful place to grow up. I mean, the scenery was beautiful. There wasn't any crime. It was basically a Norman Rockwell picture. And so in addition to that, my early years were a little hard. I was bullied a lot for being different and made fun of. And but in addition to that, I was growing up in an alcoholic home, and my dad was an alcoholic. He was violent, he was abusive, he was rageful, and my mom was the perfect other side of that coin. She was enabling, manipulative, passive-aggressive, those types of characteristics to survive, really. So it was difficult. I remember, the way I can describe my childhood is I lived in fear, and it was like going through a landmine all the time. You never knew when you're gonna get blasted. You know, the rules changed every day. And I've heard that the biggest stress that you can experience is being accountable for something you have no control of. So if the sky's orange today, guess what? You get a beating when you go. You know, it was that kind of craziness. And my way of coping with that was to become invisible. And I would sleep under the bed, I would sleep out in the garage. I was very scared all the time. And that was the way I survived, was to do that. My sister, on the other hand, she was the rebel. She acted out and she vandalized property, got arrested, stole, and smoked, and was very confrontational with everybody. And since my sister and I were born first, and we were the two girls, we weren't really wanted. My mom wanted a son. That's just what she lived for, was a son. And she tried with us, we turned out girls, and the third time she finally got her son. So he was the one to bring fame and glory to the family, and So he got all the attention, he got all the investments of, you know, he's going to go to the best private schools and he's going to become a doctor or a lawyer. Those were only the only two choices he was allowed to have. And seventh grade found out he couldn't stand the sight of blood, so he's a lawyer now. And when he graduated from law school, my mom said, I can die now. And you know, she also had said to me when I was younger, she said, if I would have had three girls, I would have been so sad. And so basically, we were chopped liver. I really feel like I was a burden to her, maybe more of a financial responsibility till she got her son. And so there was a lot of neglect after I turned five. And that's when he was born. But anyway, when I went into my later teen years, I had planned my escape, that if I can just make it to 18, I'm getting out of here. I don't care where, but I am getting out of this house, and I don't want to come back. And I did. I just held on. And a year after I had left, my sister committed suicide. And she was 16 at the time. And, you know, to me it wasn't even a surprise. It was like, living in our house, that's just a solution. That's what I thought. And I had no judgment around that. In fact, I was depressed and suicidal as well. And for years after that, I was really angry at her because she did it first, and she did it before me. And she doesn't have to live through the pain and the suffering and all this depression and the self-hatred and all the stuff that comes along with growing up in a diseased household. But I couldn't do it because I couldn't let my brother go through that again. Like, I saw him when we lost our sister, and I'm like, that's what kept me from committing suicide myself. I wanted to. I really wanted to. And I was even angry about that. You know, here I am. I want to, and I can't because, you know, I can't put him through that again. It wasn't even, you know, a concern for my parents. It was my brother that kind of kept me alive in that way. So, anyway, but God had a reason for keeping me alive. So as I go on with my life, causing all sorts of new wreckage after I left the house, I did drink a lot when I left, and I that just wasn't my drug. What I found was men, attention from men. I just sought that out. I mean, that began as early as second grade. I still remember the boy that I just like clung on to, and so I would seek that out, and that's dangerous. I mean, as I was telling my sponsor, my step four, you know, she's just like, oh my God, you've been in some dangerous situations. And I'm like, oh, I guess I have. I didn't know it at the time. I just wanted my attention, and that was it. Didn't matter if they were married, engaged, whatever. Didn't even matter if I was in a relationship. More attention was what I had craved for from men. So I made men my higher power. I had many, many higher powers in my there's a name, Tom, John, Brian, Bob, whatever. so anyway. And my MO would always to be a chameleon to what do they want me to be? And I'll be that, and they'll give me the attention that I want, and they'll stay with me, and that's what I want. I want love, you know. And just to share a story that relates to this is that I got, my neighbor's got a dog that barks. And I thought, oh no. And me being the typical Al-Anon, I don't confront anybody. I will avoid that to all lengths than to confront someone. And so I'm like, what am I going to do about this neighbor's barking? The dog's barking. And I found that there's this device that's looks like a birdhouse. And it's not really a birdhouse, just looks like one, but you point it towards the barking and it emits this high-pitched sound which is supposed to irritate the dogs or something and they stop barking. And I thought, brilliant. So I bought the little birdhouse, and at 3 a.m. the dog starts barking. So I go, okay, I'm going to test it out. And I go out there, it's 3 a.m, and I put the birdhouse on a pole because there's a concrete wall between us. And I'm waving at the dog, waving the birdhouse. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is crazy. I look like a freaking crazy person. And I thought, well, who looks crazier, the barking dog or the woman in her pajamas waving a birdhouse on a pole at 3 o'clock in the morning? And I'm the one in program. So, but I really would, I overthink things because that's my Al-Anonism. The birdhouse had to be invented by an Al-Anon person. Because, you know, you avoid confrontation. It looks like something that it's really not. You know, it's got this nice facade, but behind it, it's got this other hidden agenda, and it manipulates you to do whatever it wants you to do, but no one knows it because they think it's a birdhouse. That was the way that I lived my life. I was a freaking birdhouse, and people thought they saw something. I mean, there's probably birds coming to the birdhouse like, hey, a birdhouse, hey, we can live here. And it's not, you know. And here I was attracting people, men, women, you know, friends, whatever, with a facade, but it didn't match my insides. And I kept that hidden because I needed to manipulate. I needed to have power. I needed to control the situation. I had to make sure that you didn't leave me, because to leave me would be the end of the world. There'd be nothing left to live for. But, you know, I was left over and over and over again. And, you know, I thought, well, I'll just find a new person. I'll just find a new person. Another thing that was really a drug for me in my childhood years that I carried into adulthood was the drug of fantasy. I was very much into the whole Prince Charming and being whisked away and run off into the sunset. And, you know, I wanted to be a part of the Brady Bunch, and I made that real, and I talked to people about how I knew Greg and Marcia, and that, you know, they would come into my house and everything. So, you know, I was very, very much into the fantasy, and I, you know, life doesn't work so well when you're trying to live out that way, and it just doesn't work. So anyway, I got into a relationship, very, very tumultuous, very chaotic, very insane, like all the others, and went through like restraining orders, went through with the ex-girlfriend and courts and police and da da, and then one night he got his truck repoed. And he came back and he said, I lost my truck, got repoed. That's it, we're done. You know, And my whole thinking on that was Prince Charming would never let the carriage get repoed, because how is he supposed to take care of Cinderella, you know? No, you're not good enough. I can't take this. So that's how unmanageable my life was. So I was in therapy throughout my 20s. And then I got into Al-Anon because someone in my women's therapy group mentioned it. And I became so broke from paying for therapy that I finally decided, all right, I'll try Al-Anon. It's free. So I went, and I got good things out of it, so I kept going for about another year and a half. And then I met my next higher power, the hymn. And therefore, I didn't need Al-Anon anymore because I'm happy now. I got the man. This is what I wanted, you know. So I quit Al-Anon. And that relationship was so crazy and so insane. I hit my bottom after he broke it off after a year. And I was so devastated because... And the reason why this was different than the others, because the others I was like, all right, let's work on the mission to find the next guy. The reason why this was different is it finally hit me that I'm unlovable. I can't be loved. All these people in my life have tried, but I'm just such a piece of crap that they can't. And then everything from the past just came. It was the straw that broke the camel's back. And I was going to commit suicide that night. And I found an old phone list from when I used to go to Al-Anon. And I called a couple of people that I didn't really know too well, but I remember them from a meeting. And they saved my life that night. And I am so grateful, because without them, without that phone list, I don't know if I would have made it through the night. I also called our crisis hotline throughout the night because I couldn't sleep for the next week. And, you know, I thought, now I know that, you know, when I make men my higher power, when I make my bosses, when I make money my higher power, and I keep getting rejected, of course I'm going to be depressed and suicidal when my God keeps rejecting me. So I came, and that began step one. I was completely powerless and finally desperate enough to work this program. So I came back to the meeting that I used to go to, and I was so low. And I saw the people that I used to see in meetings from before, and I thought, look at how much they progressed from sticking with the program. So I asked someone to be my sponsor. She was actually one of the people that I had called that night of the breakup. And she said, let me pray about it for a month. Like, what? I need help now. Why? Gonna make me wait a month? I'm like, okay. So this time I'm hitting about 1-2 meetings a day because I am so in desperation. I'm calling people and everything. And finally, after a month, she comes back and she says, okay, I'm willing to do it, but we have to talk every day. That's the way I'm sponsored, and that's the way I sponsor. I'm like, oh, crap! I don't want to talk to someone every day. I'm like thinking maybe I better pray for a month. And the reason why I don't want to talk to someone every day is because if I talk to someone every day, they're going to know me. And what they're going to know, they're not going to like. And I'm going to get rejected again. So, but I was willing to go to any length. And I was so desperate. And I thought, all right. So, anyway, step one, I was completely powerless. And I say this about step one, that our lives became unmanageable. I don't think that's just enough of a good description. I always thought it should say we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives became fucked up to hell. You know? That's better than saying it's unmanageable. And you have to say it like that. Like, that should be the conference approved way of saying it. Anyway, and then step two, a higher power. I'm like, had such a problem with that because, you know, I'd hear people speak. They'd say God, they'd say he, they'd say she, you know, my higher power. And I'm thinking, I don't know. I mean, the higher power that I had kind of made up growing up was one that punished when you were bad and rewarded you when you were good, and you were never good enough, so you weren't ever going to be rewarded enough. And I thought, well, how am I going to pick a man God or a woman God? You know, I hate men. I don't trust them. And I hate women even more than men. So I'm like, what am I supposed to choose? Like a rock, a doorknob? What? So my sponsor helped me with that. And she said, well, can you think of any men that maybe yeah, to get? I'm like, my dog George. All right, let's start there. Okay. My dog George, he's a male, he never hurt me, he never rejected me, okay. And that's where I had to start, with a higher power. And I do have a higher power today. I do refer to my higher power as he, but I don't really, I mean, there's not an image of a human or anything for me. It's just more of an energy or something like that for me. And that's what works for me. And for some time, I've had to borrow my sponsor's higher power, and I've had to use the group as a higher power. So it's a process. It's a process for me. And then step three, turning it over. That's hard. That's still hard today to let go and to turn things over. One thing I'll just share real quick about that is that I parked in the metered parking outside here. I didn't go to the parking garage. So I drove by, like, $5, I can find a spot. So I find this parking spot by the meter, and I go and read the little thing on there, and it says operation hours Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, excluding Saturday, Sunday, and holidays. I'm like, okay. It says that I'm okay. But I don't trust it. So I walk up and down to see if all the other cars didn't pay. And they didn't pay, so it's okay. I can park here. And that, you know, it's like, what is that? That's some old stuff. It's like, I feel sad. No, you don't. Get over that. You don't feel that, you know. That's just this. In the program, I'm learning to come to my intuition and knowing what I feel. What do I feel? What do I like? I don't know. You know? So I'm getting to rediscover that in program. Step four. Al-Anon has a step four workbook called Blueprint for Progress. And it is intense. I mean, it's like, I don't know, has anyone ever seen that? It's like 25 chapters with like 100 questions in each chapter, and we're going through this one by one with my sponsor, and you figure like 15 minutes times 100 times 25 chapters, like took me almost 4 years to finish that workbook. And I was like, I had a graduation party at my house when I finished up 4, because I was like, you know what, people get freaking law degrees in 3 years, you know, this is a big accomplishment for me. So that was, but it was so thorough. I'm telling myself that, so I'll never have to do it again. I can just do step 10 for the rest of my life. Step 5, I did that along with my sponsor. And then step 6, taking my, or being willing to have my character defects removed. One of the helpful things that I did for my step 6 was to write, it says in our Path to Recovery book, a suggestion to write a thank you and goodbye letter to each of my character defects, like judgment, like fear. And I did that, and that was very healing for me. Right now I'm at step 7 with my sponsor, and I'm very grateful because my life is so different today. I came back to the Al-Anon working the steps, working this program, and I'm so grateful because my life is so much better than I could have ever imagined. They say, I've heard in these rooms, Al-Anon saved my life and gave me a life worth saving. And that is very, very true. I mean, you hear in Alcoholics Anonymous that, you know, it's life or death. And it is for me too, in Al-Anon as well, because our disease can kill too. I have friends now, I have happiness now, I have serenity now, I have joy now in my life, and it is amazing. And I'll just close with my favorite Al-Anon joke, because whenever I get in front of a microphone, I have to tell this joke. So there's an AA, an Al-Anon, and an Al-Ateen driving along the road. They're on a road trip. Well, their car breaks down, so they're walking on the road. They find this farmhouse. They go knock on the door, and the person answers the door, and they say, our car broke down just down the road. Is it okay if we stay here tonight? We'll get someone to fix our car tomorrow morning. The farmer says, well, I have room for two of you in the farmhouse, but one of you is going to have to sleep in the barn. So the AA person goes to, I'll do it, I'll sleep in the barn. So he sleeps in the barn. An hour later, there's a knock on the farmhouse door, and the farmer answers, and the AA says, I can't sleep, it's too loud, the dogs are barking, the ducks are quacking, the cows are mooing. The Al-Ateen says, all right, I'll go sleep in the barn. An hour later, there's a knock on the door, and the Al-Ateen says, I can't sleep. The chickens are cackling, the pigs are oinking, and what other farm animals are there? The horses are neighing. The Al-Anon says, all right, I'll go into the barn. An hour later, there's a knock on the door, and there's the ducks and the pigs and the chickens and the horses. So I just want to say thank you for staying in the barn with me and letting me share today. Thank you.
Wow, that was everyone was good, and I'd like to say thanks again to our speakers and to Trish and to Grace for coming up and helping me read. I know we're finishing up a little bit early, but that's okay. We just do it. This is how it's meant to be, I guess. This is why we're here. So again, thank you everyone for coming in here. And I want to say before I get to the closing, I just want to thank ASCEPAW. Thank you for inviting us and for welcoming Alan on to come here. I think we would like to continue this tradition. So if the next bid group gets that, keep us in mind.
I'm Carlos. I'm going to thank Virginia for putting this together.
Yay! You're welcome. And that's a long story too, because there's somebody else in here that called me and said, by the way, I gave your name to Tim. So thank you, Tricia, for that. And this has been very helpful for me in my program as well, is to get that call from Tricia. And I was real busy at the time and hung out. I called Tim and then waited longer and longer. And so it helped my program, and I'm glad I got to help with this. And I'm glad I got to meet people in ASCEPAW and go to their meetings. So again, thank you for inviting Alan on to be here. So with that, in closing, I would like to say that the opinions expressed here were strictly those of the person who gave them. Take what you like and leave the rest. The things you heard were spoken in confidence and should be treated as confidential. Keep them within the walls of this room and the confines of your mind. A few special words to those of you who haven't been with us long. Whatever your problems, there are those among us who have had them too. If you try to keep an open mind, you will come to realize that there is no situation too difficult to be bettered and no unhappiness too great to be lessened. We aren't perfect. The welcome we give you may not show the warmth we have in our hearts for you. After a while, you'll discover that though you may not like us all, you'll love us in a very special way, the same way we already love you. Talk to each other, reason things out with someone else, but let there be no gossip or criticism of one another. Instead, let the understanding and love and peace of the program grow in you one day at a time. Well, all who care to, please join me in the Al-Anon decoration. Thank you.